Now you're out there, God knows where. You're one of the walking wounded. Jan Christ from The Walking Wounded by Jan Christ and Paul Murphy. To give a man back his heart is the hardest mission on earth. From the movie Michael. Nothing worth having comes without some kind of fight. Bruce Coburn, Lovers in a Dangerous Time. A few years ago now, my middle son, Blaine, made the big transition to first grade. That's a huge step for any child, leaving the comfort and safety of mom's side, spending all day at school, being among the big kids. But Blaine's a very outgoing and winsome boy, a born leader, and we knew he'd handle it swimmingly. Every night at the dinner table, he regaled us with tales of the day's adventures. It was fun to recall with him the joys of those early school days. A shiny new lunchbox, brand new yellow number 2 pencils, a box of Crayolas with a built-in sharpener, a new desk, and new friends. We heard all about his new teacher, gym class, what they played at recess, how he was emerging as a leader in all the games. But then one night he was silent. "What's wrong, Tiger?" I asked. He wouldn't say, wouldn't even look up. "What happened?" He didn't want to talk about it. Finally, the story came out. A bully. Some first-grade poser had pushed him down on the playground in front of all of his friends. Tears were streaming down his cheeks as he told us the story. "Blaine, look at me." He raised his tearful eyes slowly, reluctantly. There was shame written all over his face. "I want you to listen very closely to what I am about to say. The next time that bully pushes you down, here's what I want you to do. Are you listening, Blaine?" He nodded, big wet eyes fixed on mine. "I want you to get up. I want you to hit him as hard as you possibly can." A look of embarrassed delight came over Blaine's face. Then he smiled. Good Lord, why did I give him such advice? And why was he delighted with it? Why are some of you delighted with it while others are appalled? Yes, I know that Jesus told us to turn the other cheek, but we have really misused that verse. You cannot teach a boy to use his strength by stripping him of it. Jesus was able to retaliate, believe me, but he chose not to. And yet we suggest that a boy who is mocked, shamed before his fellows, stripped of all power and dignity, should stay in that beaten place because Jesus wants him there? He will emasculate him for life. From that point on, all will be passive and fearful. He will grow up never knowing how to stand his ground, never knowing if he is a man indeed. Oh yes, he will be courteous, sweet even, deferential, minding all his manners. It may look moral, it may look like turning the other cheek, but it is merely weakness. You cannot turn a cheek you do not have. Our churches are full of such men. At that moment, Blaine's soul was hanging in the balance. Then the fire came back into his eyes, and the shame disappeared. But for many, many men, their souls still hang in the balance because no one has ever invited them to be dangerous, to know their own strength, to discover that they have what it takes. I feel there is this stormy ocean within me, and I keep trying to make those waters calm and placid, confessed a young friend in his early 20s. I would love to be dangerous, he said, sighing. You mean, it's possible? I feel like I have to ask permission. Why on earth would a young man have to ask permission to be a man? Because the assault continues long after the wound has been given. I don't mean to create a wrong impression. A man is not wounded once, but many, many times in the course of his life. Nearly every blow ends up falling in the same place, against his strength. Life takes it away, one vertebrae at a time, until in the end, he has no spine at all. I read a case a few years ago about a baby boy who suffered a terrible blow during his surgery. His penis was accidentally removed. The event took place back in the 70s, and a decision was made that reflected the widely held belief that sex roles are not truly part of our design, but merely shaped by culture and therefore interchangeable. His genitalia were reconstructed in female form, and he was raised as a girl. That story is a parable of our times. It is exactly what we've tried to do to boys, starting from when they are very young. As Christina Hoff Sommers says in her book, The War Against Boys, it's a bad time to be a boy in America. Our culture has turned against the masculine essence, aiming to cut it off early. As one example, she points to the way in which the shootings at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, are being used against boys in general. Most of you will remember the tragic story from April 1999. Two boys walked into the school library and began shooting. When it was all over, 13 victims and their two assailants were dead. Summers is alarmed by the remarks of William Pollack, director of the Center for Men at McLean Hospital, and so am I. Here's what he said. The boys in Littleton are the tip of the iceberg, and the iceberg is all boys. The idea, wildly held in our culture, is that the aggressive nature of boys is inherently bad, and we have to make them into something more like girls. The primary tool for that operation is our public school system. The average school teacher faces an incredible challenge to bring order to a room of boys and girls and promote learning. The main obstacle to that noble goal is getting the boys to sit still, keep quiet, and pay attention for an entire day. You might as well hold back the tide. That's not the way a boy is wired, and it's not the way a boy learns. Rather than changing the way we do male education, we try to change males. As Lionel Tiger reports in his book, The Decline of Males, boys are 3 to 4 times more likely than girls to be diagnosed as suffering from attention deficit disorder. But maybe they're not sick. Maybe, as Tiger says, this may simply mean they enjoy large muscle movements and assertive actions. Boys, as a group, appear to prefer relatively boisterous and mobile activities to the sedate and physically restricted behavior that school systems reward and to which girls seem to be more inclined. Tell me about it. This guy ought to come over to our house for dinner. With 3 boys at the table, and 1 man, but with a boyish heart, things get pretty wild at times. Chairs, for the most part, are an option. The boys use them more like gymnastic equipment than restraints. Just the other night, I look over to see Blaine balancing across his chair on his stomach like an acrobat. At the same moment, Luke, our youngest, is nowhere to be seen. Or rather, in the place at the table where his head should be, we can only see a pair of socks pointing straight up. My wife rolls her eyes. But not our school systems. As Tiger says, at least 3 to 4 times as many boys than girls are essentially defined as ill because their preferred patterns of play don't fit easily into the structure of the school. Well-meaning psychomanagers then prescribe tranquilizing drugs for ADD, such as Ritalin. The situation is scandalous. The use of drugs so disproportionately among boys betrays the failure of school authorities to understand sex differences. The only disease these boys may have is being male. But it's not just the schools. Many of them, by the way, are doing a heroic job. How about our churches? A young man recently came to me very angry and distraught. He was frustrated at the way his father, a church leader, was coaching him in sports. He's a basketball player, and his team had made the city finals. The night of the big game, as he was heading out the door, his father literally stopped him and said, "Don't go out there and kick butt. That's just not a nice thing to do." I'm not making this up. What a ridiculous thing to say to a 17-year-old athlete. Go out there and give him, well, don't give him anything. Just be nice. Be the nicest guy the opposing team has ever met. In other words, be soft. That is a perfect example of what the church tells men. Someone I read said the church may have a masculine exterior, but its soul has turned feminine. Emasculation happens in marriage as well. Women are often attracted to the wilder side of a man, but once having caught him, they settle down to the task of domesticating him. Ironically, if he gives in, he'll resent her for it, and she in turn will wonder where the passion is gone. Most marriages wind up there. A weary and lonely woman asked me the other day, "How do I get my husband to come alive?" "Invite him to be dangerous," I said. "You mean I should let him get the motorcycle, right?" "Yep." She shrank back, disappointment on her face. "I know you're right, but I hate the idea. I've made him tame for years." Think back to that great big lion in that tiny cage. Why would we put a man in a cage? For the same reason we put a lion there. For the same reason we put God there. He's dangerous. To paraphrase Sayers, we've also paired the claws of the lion cub of Judah. A man is a dangerous thing. Women don't start wars. Violent crimes aren't, for the most part, committed by women. Our prisons aren't filled with women. Columbine wasn't the work of two young girls. Obviously, something has gone wrong in the masculine soul, and the way we've decided to handle it is to take that dangerous nature away, entirely. We know that our society produces a plentiful supply of boys, says Robert Bly, but seems to produce fewer and fewer men. There are two simple reasons. We don't know how to initiate boys into men, and second, we're not sure we really want to. We want to socialize them, to be sure, but away from all that is fierce and wild and passionate. In other words, away from masculinity and towards something more feminine. But as Summer says, we have forgotten a simple truth. The energy, competitiveness, and corporal daring of normal, decent males is responsible for much of what is right in the world. Summers reminds us that during the Columbine massacre, Seth Huey threw his body over a terrified girl to shield her from the bullets. 15-year-old Daniel Roberg paid for his life when, at mortal risk to himself, he held a door open so others could escape. That strength so essential to men is also what makes them heroes. If a neighborhood is safe, it's because of the strength of men. Slavery was stopped by the strength of men at a terrible price to them and their families. The Nazis were stopped by men. Apartheid wasn't defeated by women. Who gave their seats up on the lifeboats leaving the Titanic so that women and children could be saved? And have we forgotten? It was a man who let himself be nailed to Calvary's cross. This isn't to say women can't be heroic. I know many heroic women. It's simply to remind us that God made men the way they are because we desperately need them to be the way they are. Yes, a man is a dangerous thing. So is a scalpel. It can wound or it can save your life. You don't make it safe by making it dull. You put it in the hands of someone who knows what he's doing. If you've spent any time around horses, you know a stallion can be a major problem. They're strong, very strong, and they've got a mind of their own. Stallions typically don't like to be bridled, and they can get downright aggressive, especially if there are mares around. A stallion is hard to tame. If you want a safer, quieter animal, there's an easy solution. Castrate him. A gelding is much more compliant. You can lead him around by the nose. He'll do what he's told without putting up a fuss. There's only one problem. Geldings don't give life. They can't come through for you the way a stallion can. A stallion is dangerous, all right, but if you want the life he offers, you have to have the danger, too. They go together. Let's say it's June 6th, 1944, about 07:10. You are a soldier in the third wave onto Omaha Beach. Thousands of men have gone before you, and now it's your turn. As you jump out of the Higgins boat and wade to the beach, you see the bodies of fallen soldiers everywhere, floating in the water, tossing in the surf, lying on the beach. Moving up the sand, you encounter hundreds of wounded men. Some are limping toward the bluffs with you, looking for shelter. Others are barely crawling. Snipers on the cliffs above continue to take them out. Everywhere you look, there are pain and brokenness. The damage is almost overwhelming. When you reach the cliffs, the only point of safety, you find squads of men with no leader. They are shell-shocked, stunned, and frightened. Many have lost their weapons. Most of them refuse to move. They are paralyzed with fear. Taking all this in, what would you conclude? What would be your assessment of the situation? Whatever else went through your mind, you'd have to admit, this is one brutal war, and no one would have disagreed or thought you odd for having said so. But we do not think so clearly about life, and I'm not sure why. Have a look around you. What do you observe? What do you see in the lives of men that you work with, live by, go to church alongside? Are they full of passionate freedom? Do they fight well? Are there women deeply grateful for how well their men have loved them? Are their children radiant with affirmation? The idea is almost laughable if it weren't so tragic. Men have been taken out left and right. Scattered across the neighborhood lie the shattered lives of men and women who have died at a soul level from the wounds they've taken. You've heard the expression, "He's a shell of a man." They have lost heart. Many more are alive, but badly wounded. They are trying to crawl forward, but are having an awful time getting their lives together. They seem to keep taking hits. You know others who are already captives, languishing in prisons of despair, addiction, idleness, or boredom. The place looks like a battlefield, the Omaha Beach of the soul. And that is precisely what it is. We are now in the late stages of the long and vicious war against the human heart. I know, it sounds overly dramatic. I almost didn't use the term war at all, for fear of being dismissed at this point as one more in the group of chicken littles, Christians who run around trying to get everybody worked up over some imaginary fear in order to advance their political or economic or theological cause. But I am not hawking fear at all. I am speaking honestly about the nature of what is unfolding around us, against us. And until we call the situation what it is, we will not know what to do about it. In fact, this is where many people feel abandoned or betrayed by God. They thought that becoming a Christian would somehow end their troubles, or at least reduce them considerably. No one ever told them they were being moved to the front lines, and they seem genuinely shocked at the fact that they've been shot at. After the Allies took the beachhead at Normandy, the war wasn't over. In some ways, it had just begun. Stephen Ambrose has given us many unforgettable stories of what followed that famous landing in Citizen Soldiers, his record of how the Allies won the war. Many of those stories are almost parables in their meaning. Here is one that followed on the heels of D-Day. It is June 7, 1944. Brigadier General Norman Dutch Cota, Assistant Division Commander of the 29th, came on a group of infantry pinned down by some Germans in a farmhouse. He asked the captain in command why his men were making no effort to take the building. "Sir, the Germans are in there, shooting at us," the captain replied. "Well, I tell you what, captain," said Cota, unbuckling two grenades from his jacket. "You and your men start shooting at them. I'll take a squad of men, and you and your men watch carefully. I'll show you how to take a house with Germans in it." Cota led his squad around a hedge to get as close as possible to the house. Suddenly, he gave a whoop and raced forward, the squad following, yelling like wild men. As they tossed grenades into the windows, Cota and another man kicked in the front door, tossed a couple of grenades inside, waited for the explosion, then dashed into the house. The surviving Germans inside were streaming out the back door, running for their lives. Cota returned to the captain. "You've seen how to take a house," said the general, still out of breath. "Do you understand? Do you know how to do it now?" "Yes, sir." What can we learn from the parable? Why were those guys pinned down? First, they seemed almost surprised that they were being shot at. "They're shooting at us, sir." "Hello, that's what happens in war. You get shot at. Have you forgotten? We were born into a world at war. This scene we're living in is no sitcom. It's bloody battle. Haven't you noticed with what deadly accuracy the wound was given? Those blows you've taken, they were not random accidents at all. They hit dead center. Charles was meant to be a pianist, but he never touched the piano again. I have a gift and a calling to speak into the hearts of men and women, but my wound tempted me to be a loner, live far from my heart and from others. Craig's calling is to preach the gospel like his father and great-grandfather. His wound was an attempt to take that out. He's a seagull, remember? All he can do is squawk. I failed to mention Reggie earlier. His dad wounded him when he tried to excel in school. 'You are so stupid, you'll never make it through college.' He wanted to be a doctor, but he never followed his dream. On and on it goes. The wound is too well aimed and far too consistent to be accidental. It was an attempt to take you out, to cripple or destroy your strength and get you out of the action. The wounds we've taken were leveled against us with stunning accuracy. Hopefully you're getting the picture. Do you know why there's been such an assault? The enemy fears you. You are dangerous, big time. If you ever really got your heart back, lived from it with courage, you would be a huge problem to him. You would do a lot of damage on the side of good. Remember how valiant and effective God has been in the history of the world? You are a stem of that victorious stock. Let me come back to the second lesson of the parable from D-Day plus one. The other reason those men were lying there, pinned down, unable to move, is because no one had ever shown them how to take a house before. They had been trained, but not for that. Most men have never been initiated into manhood. They have never had anyone show them how to do it, and especially how to fight for their heart. The failure of so many fathers the emasculating culture, and the passive church have left men without direction. That is why I've written this book. I am here to tell you that you can get your heart back. But I need to warn you, if you want your heart back, if you want the wound healed and your strength restored and to find your true name, you're going to have to fight for it. Notice your reaction to my words. Does not something in you stir a little, a yearning to live? And doesn't another voice rush in, urging caution, maybe wanting to dismiss me altogether? He's being melodramatic. What arrogance. Or maybe some guys could, but not me. Or, I don't know, is this really worth it? That's part of the battle, right there. See, I'm not making this up. First and foremost, we still need to know what we never heard or heard so badly from our fathers. We need to know who we are and if we have what it takes. What do we do now with that ultimate question? Where do we go to find an answer? In order to help you find the answer to the question, let me ask you another. What have you done with your question? Where have you taken it? You see, a man's core question does not go away. He may try for years to shove it out of his awareness and just get on with his life, but it does not go away. It is a hunger so essential to our souls that it will compel us to find a resolution. In truth, it drives everything we do. I spent a few days this fall with a very successful man I'll call Peter. He was hosting me for a conference on the East Coast, and when Peter picked me up at the airport, he was driving a new Land Rover with all the bells and whistles. Nice car, I thought. This guy is doing well. The next day, we drove around in his BMW 850 CSI. Peter lived in the largest house in town and had a vacation home in Portugal. None of this wealth was inherited. He worked for every dime. He loved Formula One racing and fly fishing for salmon in Nova Scotia. I genuinely liked him. Now here's a man, I said to myself. And yet, there was something missing. You'd think a guy like this would be confident, self-assured, and centered. And of course, he seemed like that at first. But as we spent time together, I found him to be hesitant. He had all the appearances of masculinity, but none of it felt like it was coming from a true center. After several hours of conversation, he admitted he was coming to a revelation. I lost my father earlier this year to cancer, but I did not cry when he died. You see, we were never really close. Ah, yes, I knew what was coming next. All these years, knocking myself out to get ahead. I wasn't even enjoying myself. What was it for? I see now. I was trying to win my father's approval. A long, sad silence. Then Peter said quietly, through tears, "It never worked." Of course not. It never does. No matter how much you make, no matter how far you go in life, that will never heal your wound or tell you who you are. But oh, how many men buy into this one? After years of trying to succeed in the world's eyes, a friend still clings stubbornly to that idea. Sitting in my office, bleeding from all his wounds, he says to me, "Who's the real stud? The guy making money." You understand that he's not making much, so he can still chase the illusion. Men take their soul's search for validation in all sorts of directions. Brad is a good man who for so many years now has been searching for a sense of significance through belonging. As he said, "Out of my wounds, I figured out how to get life. I'll find a group to belong to, do something incredible that others will want, and I'll be somebody. First, it was the right gang of kids in school. Then it was the wrestling team. Years later, it was the right ministry team. It has been a desperate search, by his own admission, and it hasn't gone well. When things didn't work out earlier this year at the ministry he was serving, he knew he had to leave. My heart has burst and all the wounds and arrows have come pouring out. I have never felt such pain. The sentences scream at me. I do not belong. I am wanted by no one. I am alone." Where does a man go for a sense of validation? To what he owns? To who pays attention to him? How attractive his wife is? Where he gets to eat out? How well he plays sports? The world cheers the vain search on. Make a million. Run for office. Get a promotion. Hit a home run. Be somebody. Can you feel the mockery of it all? The wounded crawl up the beach while the snipers fire away. But the deadliest place a man ever takes his search, the place every man seems to wind up, no matter what trail he's followed, is the woman. Remember the story of my first kiss, that little darling I fell in love with in the 7th grade, and how she made my bicycle fly? I fell in love with Debbie the very same year my father checked out of my story, the year I took my deepest wound. The timing was no coincidence. In a young boy's development, there comes a crucial time when the father must intervene. It arrives early in adolescence, somewhere between the ages of 11 and 15, depending on the boy. If that intervention does not happen, the boy is set up for disaster. The next window that opens in his soul is sexuality. Debbie made me feel like $1 million. I couldn't have put it into words at the time. I had no idea what was really going on. But in my heart, I felt I had found the answer to my question. A pretty girl thinks I'm the greatest. What more can a guy ask for? If I've found Juliet, then I must be Romeo. When she broke up with me, it began what has been a long and sad story of searching for the woman that will make me feel like a man. I went from girlfriend to girlfriend, trying to get an answer, to be the hero to the beauty. That has been my longing, my image of what it means to really, finally be a man. Bly calls it the search for the golden-haired woman. He sees a woman across the room, knows immediately that it is she. He drops the relationship he has, pursues her, feels wild excitement, passion, beating heart, obsession. After a few months, everything collapses. She becomes an ordinary woman. He is confused and puzzled. Then he sees once more a radiant face across the room, and the old certainty comes again. Why is pornography the most addictive thing in the universe for men? Certainly, there's the fact that a man is visually wired, that pictures and images arouse men much more than they do women. But the deeper reason is because that seductive beauty reaches down inside and touches your desperate hunger for validation as a man you didn't even know you had. Touches it like nothing else most men have ever experienced. You must understand, this is deeper than legs and breasts and good sex. It is mythological. Look at the lengths men will go to find the golden-haired woman. They have fought duels over her beauty. They have fought wars. You see, every man remembers Eve. We are haunted by her. And somehow, we believe that if we could find her, get her back, then we'd also recover with her our own lost masculinity. You'll recall the little boy, Philip, from the movie A Perfect World. Remember what his fear was? That his penis was puny. That's how many men articulate a sense of emasculation. Later in life, a man's worst fear is often impotence. If he can't get an erection, then he hasn't got what it takes. But the opposite is also at work. If a man can feel an erection, well, then he feels powerful. He feels strong. I'm telling you, for many men, the question feels hardwired to his penis. If he can feel like the hero sexually, well then, mister, he's the hero. Pornography is so seductive because what is a wounded, famished man to think when there are literally hundreds of beauties willing to give themselves to him? Of course, it's not just to him, but when he's alone with the photos, it feels like it's just for him. It's unbelievable how many movies center around this lie. Get the beauty, win her, bed her, and you're the man. You're James Bond. You're a stud. Look carefully at the lyrics to Bruce Springsteen's song, Secret Garden, from his greatest hits recording, 1995. She'll let you in her house if you come knocking late at night. She'll let you in her mouth if the words you say are right. If you pay the price, she'll let you deep inside. But there's a secret garden she hides. She'll lead you down a path. There'll be tenderness in the air. She'll let you come just far enough so you know she's really there. She'll look at you and smile, and her eyes will say, she's got a secret garden, where everything you want, where everything you need, will always stay 1,000,000 miles away. It's a deep lie wedded to a deep truth. Eve is a garden of delight, but she's not everything you want, everything you need, not even close. Of course, it will stay 1,000,000 miles away. You can't get there from here because it's not there. It's not there. The answer to your question can never, ever be found there. Don't get me wrong. A woman is a captivating thing, more captivating than anything else in all creation. The naked woman's body is a portion of eternity too great for the eye of man. Femininity can arouse masculinity. Boy, oh boy, can it. My wife flashes me a little breast, a little thigh, and I'm ready for action. All systems alert. She tells me in a soft voice that I'm a man and I'll leap tall buildings for her. But femininity can never bestow masculinity. It's like asking a pearl to give you a buffalo. It's like asking a field of wildflowers to give you a 57 Chevy. They are different substances entirely. When a man takes his question to the woman, what happens is either addiction or emasculation, usually both. Dave, whose father blew a hole in his chest when he called him Mama's boy, took his question to the woman. Recently, he confessed to me that younger women are his obsession. You can see why. They're less of a threat. A younger woman isn't half the challenge. He can feel more like a man there. Dave's embarrassed by his obsession, but it doesn't stop him. A younger woman feels like the answer to his question, and he's got to get an answer. But he knows his search is impossible. He admitted to me just the other day, "Even if I marry a beautiful woman, I will always know there's an even more beautiful woman out there somewhere. So I'll wonder, could I have won her?" It's a lie. As Bly says, it's a search without an end. We are looking at the source of a lot of desperation in certain men here, and a lot of suffering in certain women. How often I've seen this. A friend's brother hit rock bottom a few years back when his girlfriend broke up with him. He was a really successful guy, a high school star athlete who became a promising young attorney. But he was carrying a wound from an alcoholic, workaholic father who never gave him what every boy craves. Like so many of us, he took his heart with its question to the woman. When she dumped him, my friend said, it blew him out of the water. He went into a major nosedive, started drinking heavily, smoking. He even left the country. His life was shattered. This is why so many men secretly fear their wives. She sees him as no one else does, sleeps with him, knows what he's made of. If he has given her the power to validate him as a man, then he has also given her the power to invalidate him too. That's the deadly catch. A pastor told me that for years he's been trying to please his wife, and she keeps giving him an F. What if she is not the report card on you, I suggested. She sure feels like it, and I'm failing. Another man, Richard, became verbally abusive toward his wife in the early years of their marriage. His vision for his life was that he was meant to be Romeo, and therefore she must be Juliet. So when she turned out to not be the golden-haired woman, he was furious. Because that meant, you see, that he was not the heroic man. I remember seeing a picture of Julia Roberts without costume and makeup. Oh, I realized, she's just an ordinary woman. He was coming to me for his validation, a young woman told me about the man she was dating, or had been dating. She was drawn to him at first, and certainly drawn to the way he was taken with her. That's why I broke up with him. I was amazed at her perceptiveness and her courage. It's very rare to find, especially in younger women. How wonderful it feels at first to be his obsession. To be thought of as a goddess is pretty heady stuff. But eventually, it all turns from romance to immense pressure on her part. He kept saying, "I don't know if I have what it takes, and you're telling me I don't." He'll thank me for it someday. What's fascinating to note is that homosexuals are actually more clear on this point. They know that what is missing in their hearts is masculine love. The problem is that they've sexualized it. Joseph Nicolosi says that homosexuality is an attempt to repair the wound by filling it with masculinity, either the masculine love that was missing or the masculine strength many men feel they do not possess. It, too, is a vain search, and that is why the overwhelming number of homosexual relationships do not last, why so many gay men move from one man to another, and why so many of them suffer from depression and a host of other addictions. What they need can't be found there. Why have I said all this about our search for validation and the answer to our question? Because we cannot hear the real answer until we see we've got a false one. So long as we chase the illusion, how can we face reality? The hunger is there. It lives on our souls like a famished craving, no matter what we've tried to fill it with. If you take your question to Eve, it will break your heart. I know this now after many, many hard years. You can't get your answer there. In fact, you can't get your answer from any of the things men chase after to find their sense of self. There is only one source for the answer to your question. And so no matter where you've taken your question, you've got to take it back. You have to walk away. That